guys, welcome back to the podcast. This podcast is sponsored by nobody. Isn't that great? All right, let's get into it. Caffeine and Questions Part 6. It's been a couple of months since I did one of these, and obviously I was doing all the podcasts kind of about my career, which have taken a sharp turn lately. So I decided, I try to answer questions sometimes, but I decided to throw out a ask me a question thing, and I got a lot of questions. And a lot of really good questions, actually. And I guess that's partly because of the podcast I've been putting out, so people kind of know what to ask me a little better. So I'm going to try to answer some of them. I got about 30 questions on why I left Fieldcraft. And it is, I'm not going to talk about that because it's super easy to leave a company and then take cheap shots from the sideline. That's just not who I am. And if people really knew me, they wouldn't even ask, because I'm just not going to do that. It's unprofessional, it's childish, and it's not who I am, okay? So looking forward, moving on, super excited about the future, have a ton of plans, which I'll get into at the very end of this. And I'm really, really pumped about the future and what's coming up, and it's very exciting. I put out a thing on YouTube, and I put one on Instagram about, hey, I'm moving on, I'm leaving Fieldcraft, it's just that time. And I got tons and tons and tons of messages and support. And it's very humbling, and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much. We concentrate on the negativity on social media a lot, but there's some really cool people out there. I mean, people were messaging me and saying, hey, we have a ranch in Montana, you're welcome to come and stay there, or hey, if you're coming through here, I'll buy you a beer. And it was really, really cool and very, very encouraging. So I am going to keep the podcast, I am going to keep the YouTube channel, and I am going to do some training and consulting moving forward. And like I said, I will kind of catch you up on that later, okay? I went through all the questions, and I pulled out some here that I'll kind of get into. And like I said, a lot of people ask me when I left. People are asking me what I think about the train derailment and the Chinese balloon and all that stuff. And I really don't want to make little of your question, but I just don't understand why people are asking me that, because the people who ask me that probably know more about it than I do, because I don't track that stuff. I really don't care. And for me to answer that question or give my opinion, I would have to do research, and I'd have to kind of filter through a bunch of garbage and the internet, and I'd have to kind of give you my take. And if you think that I have some inside information through the government, through intelligence or special, I don't. I'm a civilian, and you probably know more about that than I do. So I think it's human nature. I try to do stuff that I would want to listen to on social media, and I don't want to listen to people talking about their opinion on stuff like that. I try to do the road less traveled, and that's why I'll never be very successful on YouTube or podcasts or anything like that, because the YouTube algorithm, the Instagram algorithm, they promote controversy, they promote sensationalism, that clickbait that gets more engagement, and they like that, so they'll push that to the top of the feed, and I'm just not going to do that. It's not my thing. I've been told to spruce up my posters that kind of I have on my YouTube videos to sensationalize them a bit more and get people that I'm not doing that. I'm just not. I had one, how to zero your rifle, and somebody said, you need to write, like, you suck at zeroing your rifle, or you're doing it wrong. And I'm like, I'm not writing that. Maybe they're doing it better than I do. I don't freaking know. So I'm not willing to do those things. And if you're looking for me to do that, or if you're looking for me to, you know, talk about Fieldcraft, you probably want to go watch cat videos, because I'm not going to do that. Okay. All right, I'm going to get into some questions that I've pulled out here. Best advice you could give to young up-and-coming leaders. So leadership is something that's very near and dear to my heart, and I've learned so much. I read a quote recently by Patton, and he said, as I gain more experience, I don't think more of myself, I just think less of others. And I think as you go on in life, you just realize that there's a lot of people out there faking it. And the things you thought you couldn't do, you actually can do. And we put these artificial barriers in front of us, right? So young up-and-coming leaders, the army have, this is a whole podcast in itself, and I will go through it, and I will talk about leadership, and I will talk about good and bad leaders I had, and things I've learned, and I continue to learn to this day. Here's a couple of little tidbits, right? And the army pushed this on you very early. When you're a team leader in the army and a fire team in charge of like three guys, you're responsible for everything they do and fail to do. same as a squad leader, platoon sergeant, down the line, right? The buck stops with you. You can't be an infantry squad leader, let's say, and say, my squad's screwed up and it's that guy's fault, right? The buck stops at you. It's on you. Within your sphere of influence, you're the guy who makes the calls, you're in charge. Now, if you're a battalion commander and you're a group commander, whatever that is, obviously the bigger the organization, the less control you have. I remember Brian Edwards, who's a good friend of mine, and he was the regiment command sergeant major for special forces, which means he was in charge of every Green Beret on the planet as the senior command sergeant major. And he was talking to me one time, and he was like, when I was a team sergeant and in charge of 12 guys, and I was thinking, oh man, if I was a company sergeant major, I could get so much done. And then he became a company sergeant major, and he was thinking, if I was a battalion sergeant major, oh man, I could change things and I could influence things. And then when he was a battalion sergeant major, he was like, if I was a group sergeant major. And then all the way up, he was the command sergeant major of the Special Forces Regiment. And he realized that he never had as much control as he had when he was a team sergeant, because they're the guys you can reach out and joke if you have to. Not literally, but the buck stops with you as a junior leader. That's one. And don't blame other people. Then the other thing is, never give subordinates ammunition against you. I've seen this time and time again. If you do anything unethical, illegal, or immoral, and you do it and your subordinates know about it, you can never, ever discipline them again. You've lost all control. So never, ever, ever compromise your integrity. And integrity is probably one of the most important things to have as a leader and as a person, doing what's right, whether anybody's watching or not. Okay? I will give more kind of guidance on that. I think there's so many aspects to leadership, and I've learned so much about leadership over the last freaking 35, 40 years. I would really like to go down this road, because there's a lot of bad advice out there, and there's a lot of things you learn as a leader as you go, and there's no kind of shortcut. So I'll get back to that one. The key differences between the National Guard and Reserve. The National Guard is actually state level, right? It's funded by the state. The Reserve is federal, right? The National Guard is combat arms. The reserves are support. That's why Army Special Forces have National Guard units, but they don't have reserve units, because they're a combat arms element. So when my daughter was going into the military and she wanted to go into the National Guard or the Reserve, she wasn't really sure, we sat down with Meredith, who's a good friend of mine. She's a lieutenant colonel, I think, now in the Army Reserve. And she said, look, the National Guard is funded by the state, and it's very state to state, and some are well-funded and some are badly funded. The reserves are actually all funded by the federal government, so they're more consistent across the board, and it's probably a better option for that reason if you don't want to go into a combat arms unit. So that's the key difference between the National Guard and the Reserve. It's funny, when I worked in Force Mod, that I used to talk to one of the supply, like, main head guys who would ship new equipment to every unit all over, you know, SF. He'd send stuff to like 19th or 20th group, and it would arrive in a state, and the state would just take it. And he was like, I wouldn't be able to get it back, you know? They kind of do their own thing. I've never been in the National Guard or the Reserve. I had a young man in here maybe a week ago at a class here at Philcroft, and he was thinking about going into, he was already in the National Guard, and he was thinking about going into SF in the National Guard. And I put him on the phone with a good friend of mine, Jimmy, and he was in SF National Guard, and he talked him through the whole thing and gave him some great advice. But that's the key differences, one's federal, one's state. How did you balance married life and SF and all the deployments? Not well, not well. I'm always not here, but Andy Stump, I think, put it best when I talked to him. He said, the job suffers last. And I've talked about this before. I remember a quote from We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and where Mel Gibson, you know, that movie, Mel Gibson was talking to a junior officer, and he said, how do you balance being a father and being a soldier? And Mel Gibson said, I like to think that if I'm, you know, being good at one makes me better at the other, or good at the other. And I think that's almost the opposite. I think you can only have so much resources to kind of, you've only got so much of you to share, right? So if you bust your ass and you live for your job, then your family's going to suffer. If you're a family man and which is the most important thing, and then it's going to be hard to deploy and be gone for long periods of time. It's very difficult to strike that balance. It's probably easier now because dwell time, which means the time you spend back after the deployment, is much better than it was during my time because we're not fighting two wars. I'm almost ashamed to say I prioritized the job more than I should have. I wanted to deploy, and I wanted to deploy again. And even when I worked in cyber school, I worked my ass off, and I worked nights, and I worked. But when I look back, I am still married to a strong woman who raised my kids, and I have great kids, and they did a really great job. My daughter actually married a young man, and hey, shout out to Dana. She listens to this, but Dana married a young man whose dad is an SF guy as well, because they met here in high school. At the wedding, I was asked to make a speech, and I said, look, you're dealing with two really, really squared away young Americans right there who were raised by the mothers, and the dads were not there because we were both deployed all the time. And those two women, my wife and this young man's wife, they deserve the credit for that. They raised these kids by themselves pretty much. Military spouses are like that. They have to be like that. They have to be strong. They have to do all the bills, and they have to do all, especially during a time of war. I did not balance it well. I wish I'd done a better job. I'm trying to fix that right now. But you got to figure what the priority is, and the priority should always be your family. That's a difficult one for me, but it is what it is. At the time, I didn't see it. But again, you have to be with a strong spouse, right, who understands. All right, moving on there. That's a hard one for me to talk about. What made you want to serve? I would like to say I had this lofty service goal. When I was in America, I was working construction. And so let's go back to the Irish Army. What made me want to serve in the Irish Army? I wanted a job that wasn't boring, that I thought might be cool and fun, right? No aspirations to go into special operations in Ireland. Just wanted to do a job that wasn't. And when I joined the Army in Ireland, there was no jobs. There was very, very few. It was very hard to get a job. You used to be able to get an apprenticeship sometimes, but a lot of times the government would pay your wages to be an apprentice for a year or two. And then the employer was supposed to take over your pay. And a lot of times, it happened to my brother, the employer would keep you on for 2 years and then find a reason to fire you and then hire another guy and get another guy free for 2 years, right? Just to be a manual labor. And I just didn't, none of that ever appealed to me. So if there's no jobs in Ireland, it was go to England, go to America. And even join the army was not an option. But when they recruited and I joined because I thought it would be a pretty cool job, there wasn't any lofty service goal. Now, when I went to America, I was working construction. And again, I'd love to say that I just wanted to serve and serve my country. That wasn't the case. I thought it would be a good job. I thought it would be fun, even though it was the 90s and the army had been gutted. I actually thought about becoming a cop, and I thought maybe I'll do 3 years in the army first and then I'll pivot into the police department. I'm glad I didn't do that because police in this country are underpaid, over-scrutinized, overworked, and underappreciated. And they have a horrible, horrible job, and they're keeping the fabric of society together. But it wasn't this big, lofty, want to serve my country goal. It was, I thought it would be a cool job, and I thought it would pivot into something different. And I just went in, and it turned into a 24-year career. I have a lot of people in Ireland that reach out to me. Would you recommend staying in Ireland in the Army Ranger Wing or moving to the US and going to Rangers SF? It's very hard for me to answer questions like that because I have no idea what your goals are, what your family is like, what I can only talk about my experiences, right? America suited me, and I people ask me, is it better to live in America or Ireland? That's on you. America suited me better than Ireland, I think. That doesn't mean it's better or worse. I just think it's better for me. Your personality, your background, all that kind of thing is going to help you make that decision, right? If you go into the Irish Army and you stay and you go to the Ranger Wing, you can have a cool job, you can do cool stuff. You're probably not going to go into combat anywhere. Let's be realistic. You're in a neutral country, but you'll get some great training and you'll meet some great folks and you'll have a job that's really, really cool. If you go into the American military, and you go into Ranger Regiment or SF, and you do you're going to probably see combat at some stage. There's no combat right now, but SF are all over the world. They're training indigenous forces. They're doing stuff that people don't even know about. You'll get some great schools. You'll meet some great folks, but it's going to depend. Now, I will say that if you're an Irish citizen and you want to come to the American military, you're going to have to renounce your citizenship. That is the thing. And because they will not give you a security clearance without, if you're a dual citizen. Just bear that in mind, okay? What do you miss about the Ranger Wing, and how would you feel it could progress better in Ireland? I don't know much about the Ranger Wing now. I think it's come leaps and bounds since I was there. It was pretty primitive when I was there. We had good gear, we had good, solid guys, but it's come leaps and bounds. The only kind of interaction I have with the Ranger Wing was through guys who would come to the USASOC sniper competition. USASOC is the United States Army Special Operations Command, and those guys would come, and generally the same guys. And they come every year. And when they came first, they struggled and they didn't have the right gear. And then they come back with better gear and better tactics and better training, and they do better and they do better and they do better. That's really the only interaction I have with anybody in the Ranger Wing. So I don't know where they sit right now. I will say that early on when I was there, all the training was very, very recycled, right? It was, you learn from this guy and then he teaches next guy, and you have to bring in outside trainers because you don't know what you don't know, and it gives you a completely different look. And while I was there, guys would go to the Royal Dutch Marines, they went to GIGN, French. Some people went to the British Army, but not to the SAS, to like recce commander's courses, officers went there. The guys went to some other European armies and they trained, right? And then they brought back new TTPs, and some of them were great and some of them were garbage. They brought back a lot of minimum force stuff from France, and I that's a whole nother podcast. But you have to bring in outside influence. You have to bring in outside TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures if you want to grow. You can't just recycle the same stuff because things do change. So I've seen pictures and stuff. The Irish Army looks very professional compared to when I was in it. And I'm sure they have some great people, but I don't feel comfortable commenting on where they're at right now because I just don't know. People have asked me, would you go back to, I think I have one of them questions, would you go back to the Ranger Wing and teach? The Ranger Wing would never hire me to do that. I would in a heartbeat. I would go back to the wherever they train, you know, officers, and do a public speaking thing about combat and all that and experience. If they would pay my, even if they just paid my flight, I would do that because it would be really cool. But I'm not sure they're looking for that. I think I give a unique perspective because I've been in two different armies and I'm very grounded. I think I am. The day I don't get grounded and I start bragging about myself, please call me out. But I would do that in a heartbeat if they would hire me, if they would do it. But when can we expect a book? We're waiting. I'm not a book guy. I'm just not. Maybe someday. But I know I talked to Jack Carr about this, and Jack's an author, so I knew he wanted to talk about it, but I just don't see it. It's a commitment, and not that I have commitment freaking phobia, but I don't like, if I ever did it, I would do it, and I wouldn't mention it until it was done, because if I put it out there, I would feel pressure, and it would freaking destroy me. I would destroy me, but it would be a pain, but it's like somebody suggested to me going forward that I do online training and I have a subscription. And I'm like, if I have a subscription base for classes every month, that's a commitment I have. And I always want to under-promise and over-deliver. So I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. I have no plans to write a book. I don't know. It's just not me. At least not now. What's one thing you'd tell a young version of yourself? You guys, for crushing questions, man. I was like, damn. I don't think I ever talked about this before, but at the end of the Jack Carr podcast, somehow we got on the subject of confidence, right? And I grew up in Ireland, and I'm not bashing Ireland, but at the time, there was, I didn't grow up with a lot of confidence. Very, very scrutinized myself a lot, kind of second-guessed myself a lot. And I, to this day, right? And people are like, oh, you seem very confident. I'm not. I'm okay in, like when I started working with Mike and Fieldcraft, Mike was like, just put the camera on, put your phone on, turn the camera, just start talking. I was like, I can't do that. That's you. That's not me. And here I am right now, right? So I think we put obstacles in our way that don't exist, and we all do it. But I have done it my entire life. Like I have been put in charge of things when people said, oh, we're going to make you, put you in charge. I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. And I do really, really well at it. What I would tell a younger version of myself is most people are faking it. The super confident people are faking it more than anybody else. And when you put obstacles in your way, there's nothing wrong with being humble. There's nothing wrong with having high standards and kind of expecting a lot from yourself. But if you put too many obstacles in your way, they don't exist. And the people who don't put them in the way seem super confident, and they'll do anything, and they'll get up there in front of anybody. But you're no different, right? If you look at my career and the how long I've been doing this, I could do probably a lot more. The problem is I'm not willing to do the things on social media that would make me super popular, right? You'll never see freaking Green Beret sniper teaches this, or, oh, no shit, there I was. This clickbait crap. I just won't do it. I'm not comfortable with it, and I just won't do it. But had I to go back, I would try to not put as many barriers in my way as possible, right? And I haven't gotten to it yet, but I might as well. Like 5 or 6 people asked me, did you ever think about going to Delta Force? Or were you able to go to Delta Force? Or, you know, why did you not go to Delta Force? Or did you go to Delta Force? Or I could have went to Delta Force. I could have went to CAG, they call it, right? Combat Applications Group, but Delta. I could have went to Delta Selection. Now, part of me, the reason I didn't go is because I missed my window, because I came in the Army late, and I was like 35 when I went to SF Selection because I wasn't a US citizen. And when I got there, I got in. I wasn't happy for the first couple of years because I was on a team that I did not suit. But when I got to the Civ Company, I was on a team there. I really liked it. And then all of a sudden I was on SWIC. And I remember teaching snipers from Delta in SODIC. And they were like, dude, you got to come over. You got to... I was like, nah, I'm too old, you know, I'm 40. And they're like, we got guys that are 40. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not starting. And I think me putting those obstacles in my way was fear of failure on my part a little bit, if I was being honest with myself. And again, that's a barrier that went up that was artificial, because I hold Delta in a very, very high esteem, best unit in the world probably, right, at what they do. Could I have passed selection? Probably. Could I have functioned and thrived in that unit? Probably. Because I think I hold a lot of the same values, a very high standards of myself. But that fear of failure stopped me trying. And that's a horrible reason to not do something. So that's one of my shortcomings, and has always been, and is to this day probably. Okay, man. This is a weird one. Was the M4 reliable in Iraq? Yes, it was. It was super reliable. I saw one malfunction in a close quarter scenario where the guy ran in, guy came at him, he fired his rifle at a malfunction, and he transitioned to his Glock and shot him his Glock. But if you look at the guns in the Army, right, and SOCOM have their own version of the M4, but they're kind of beat up, they're rattly, they're not like a precision rifle that you would see in the civilian world. Like if you pick up a really well-built rifle from like JP Rifles or something like that, and then you hold an Army rifle, even in Special Ops, it's rackety and it's been beat up and all that, but that's just the nature of the beast. But they worked. They never failed, and I think it's a great platform, and I never had any reliability problems, and I'm not a big cleaner of guns, to be honest. Those things ran very, very well. Would you ever consider visiting Ireland and training with the Ranger Wing? I'd love to. Never going to happen. Somebody wrote, struggle with math, want to be a sniper for my local SWAT, advice. I'm terrible at math. If you're going to sniper training and they're telling you you have to be good at math, I would question what they're teaching you. I'm terrible at math. Terrible. And always have been. I one of the things I would like to get into, because I think there's a big gap in the market, is training law enforcement snipers. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful or talk trash about them, but police sniper teams, SWAT sniper teams, they're reluctant to spend money on that. They'll train pistol and carbine and CQB and all that stuff. But the shooting piece, the sniper piece, they're reluctant to spend money on it because they don't know what they don't know. And as far as they're concerned, they can lay down and shoot tiny, tiny holes in a target at 100 yards. And that's good enough. Now, it might be. That might be all you need for your job. But there is so much more to that craft. And I taught class, a 2-day class at the Arkansas Tactical Officers Association last year. And within a couple of hours, guys were like, oh my God, I've never heard any of this before, right? And I'm not tooting my own horn, but I lived this life for years and years and years, and it's kind of my passion. But if I'd love to pivot into that, but law enforcement, again, underfunded, very reluctant to spend money on that. If you're being told you have to be good at math to be a sniper, I would really question what they're teaching you, because you don't. You absolutely don't. Why did the Army go with a BDC, a ballistic or bullet drop compensator, over a grid reticle for the squad designated marksman rifle? Because most people don't know how to shoot in mils or minutes of angle. And SF went with a BDC grid, and that was, I think that was my decision or my guy's decision, for the 1-6, because a bullet drop compensated reticle is, okay, he's a 300, you hold 3, shoot. He's a 400, you hold 4, shoot. Most Green Berets, most Rangers, most soldiers, say military people, do not know how to shoot in minutes of angle or mils, because it's just not what they do, unless they're sniper qualified. So a BDC reticle is easy to use, it's easy to train on, and it's good enough for what they're using. And it's the right decision. BDC is the right decision for a DMR rifle. 1-6, something with a carbine. It gets you what you need. And a gridded reticle is just, it's more training they would need when they're already saturated with things they have to learn. So it's the right decision, and that's why. Greatest accomplishment in the military. This one threw me a little bit, because I don't really have a lot of great accomplishments. I would like to think when I was a first sergeant at the Warrior Leader Course, I was able to influence young soldiers and steer them in the right direction. I would like to think that. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was my goal when I took that job, was to be able to get in their heads nice and early in their career and put them on the right path for success. And that's what I would like to think I did, but it might not be true. Other than that, there was a few other things, but nothing earth-shattering, honestly. So widow with teens at home, limited time, money, best option for personal protection. Ma'am, I would highly encourage you to reach out to Rosie Kabar on Instagram. Rosie Kabar is Kirsten Morgan. She is teaching a class actually today on personal security. She will give you as much. This is a big subject, right? And I think a lot of the protection security advice that's out there is completely geared, it's too tactical, it's too expensive, it's too unrealistic for most people. And I'll talk about this later on, but there's a gap in the market for real training for real people, regular folks like you and me. And so I don't want to get into this now. There's a lot of moving parts here, but please reach out to Kirsten at Rosie Kabar, and she will help you. She's a phenomenal instructor, and I really, really trust her. Biggest takeaway, lessons learned from your time in special operations. And I meant to think about this and I didn't, but man, your reputation, right? Your reputation follows you your whole life, right? If I applied for a job now, somebody could make 2 phone calls and find out everything about me, even if they'd never looked at social media, because social media is fake most of the time, but they could make 2 phone calls and talk to somebody who knew me in person in the military and find out everything about me, right? Your reputation follows you everywhere you go. And it sounds like a cliche, but it's not. If somebody applied for a job with me, I could make a couple of, and they were in special operations, no matter what, if they were SEAL, Air Force, I could make a couple of phone calls and find out everything about them. And people will not back you up if you have a bad reputation, because they don't want their reputation tied to that bad reputation. It really does follow you everywhere you go. And it's kind of flattering to me that guys who worked for me when I was a team sergeant, guys who worked for me when I ran sniper school, came back and I was able to pull them into the first mod office because they liked working for me. That tells me that I did the right thing when I was a team sergeant, right? If I was an asshole, then they wouldn't want to work for me. But that's kind of the biggest takeaway. As soon as you compromise yourself, and I have people reach out to me a lot and go, hey, what do you think about this guy? We want to hire him. And I'm pretty hard on people. My standards are pretty high and I will not mince words. I'll be like, I wouldn't hire him. He's a dirtbag. Or I wouldn't hire him. I personally don't like him. And I think this, right? Or I'd say, this guy's a rock star. I would hire him in a heartbeat. But my standards are quite high in that world. So if you're coming into special operations, just remember that it will follow you, even from the Q course. It will follow you throughout your whole career. And that's kind of my biggest takeaway, I think. How do you recover and get back into the mentality of a warrior after serious surgery or injury? When I was still active, I used to run. I was a big runner. It was like therapy for me. It really shut my brain down. I could run for miles and miles and miles. I used to run like 8 miles a day, 6 or 7 times a week. And I absolutely love running. It was my thing. Now, when I was in the Middle East in 2012 or 13, I was running like crazy. And my feet started getting really, really sore, like the soles of my feet. And I didn't know what it was. It was plantar fasciitis, right? But I didn't know at the time what it was. And I get up in the morning, I go for a long run, I come back and I'd stick my feet in big vat of ice water to take the swelling down. And I changed shoes and I tried insoles and I went to physical therapy and nothing would get control of it. And then I came back, I remember, and it was right before Christmas in 2013, I think. And I went for a run and I ran like 16 miles and I felt great. And then the next day I ran for a run and my calf tore. And it was basically my body telling me, hey, dumbass, stop running on your feet, they're jacked up. But I would take a painkiller and I would go because I was so addicted to running. But when my calf tore, it would put me out for about 6 weeks. It's about 2-3 weeks of limping and a couple more weeks of not being able to run. And when it recovered, I would go for a run right away and it would tear again. And it would tear on both sides. And it got to the point where I could not run anymore. I just had to stop. Now, I tried cycling and I tried rowing and I tried other things, but nothing gave me that runner's high. And that I would go on autopilot and my feet felt like they weren't even touching the ground. And I absolutely loved it. Not being able to run, and my calf tore the first time right before Christmas and I was off for like 2 weeks. And I couldn't run. And I was limping because I tore my calf. And it destroyed me mentally. No, it didn't destroy me. It pushed me into depression almost. Because all of a sudden that was taken away. And I was done. And I could not pivot out of it. And it really did take a piece of me. And I can't run to this day. And I've stopped running completely. Because I just can't do it. I have to face up to the facts. I hate not being at 100%. Right now I have 2 torn shoulder blades, which are jacked up and getting sore every day. But if I do surgery on it, I'll end up with that big cast thing. And I just don't want to do that. I have too much going on. And that's a terrible excuse, I know. But I just don't want to do that. So as a young man, I would say, or a woman, I would say, get the surgery, get it fixed, and move on. I've been picking up injuries for 20 years, and I just ignored them all. And I have a bullet fragment in my left hand that you put a metal detector in and it'll go off. I've been picking up injuries my whole freaking life and I just ignored them all. And now they're coming back to haunt me. And someday, the bulging disc in my neck, my back fractured, my shoulder, it will stop me. And it'll put me down hard. But I'm too freaking ignorant and stubborn to do anything about it right now. But if you do it, do the recovery. Don't rush it. And you'll build yourself back up slowly. If you try to rush it, you'll be out again with another injury. So understand that if you're young, you have time, and the time you invest in recovery is going to pay off dividends later on. Okay, and your warrior mentality and your push and your drive, it was there before, it'll be there again. You just got to not rush it. Thoughts on side plates? When would you use or omit them? I don't know. So side plates are body armor, ballistic plates that go on the side of your body armor. So we were issued those in SF and I never wore them. But it's interesting because people get shot here and here and here all the time and they live. Almost everybody gets shot in the side, freaking dies, because that's where you shoot a deer. You puncture both lungs and the heart, you're done, right? It's a horrible place to get shot. So side plates are absolutely a good idea, but I never wore them. Now, if you're in a vehicle and you're driving around an armored vehicle, there's no need not to have side plates, and you should have all the armor you can. But again, I'm preaching something that I didn't do and I never wore them, but they're getting lighter and lighter. And if it's not going to, there's a balance, right? There's a balance between mobility and protection. And if you overdo the protection piece, you're going to reduce the mobility piece. That's why when we were running around in Afghanistan up in the mountains, I had no body armor on. I had a baseball cap and a chest rack because I had to keep up an indige. But driving around in Iraq, you need a lot of armor on. There's no excuse, right? So there's a balance. So you got to pick that balance yourself. If it's going to hurt your mobility, you might have to drop them. But I remember going to Sephardic, which is our CQB hostage rescue school. It's 9 weeks long. And we wore paraclete body armor and magazines and radios. And all. By the end of that course, that whole body armor, 40-pound vest, felt like a T-shirt because we were so used to it. That's on you. But personally, I never wore them. But I do think they're very, very crucial. And if they're not going to hurt your mobility and hurt your survivability through hurting your mobility, you can probably wear them. First or second focal plane, there's no No such thing as always, no such thing as never. First focal plane has its place, second focal plane has its place. I don't want to get this about ballistics because there's a small amount of people who give a crap, but if I'm running the reticle, the optics, SOCOM picked for the low power variable optics SIG when it's a second focal plane, because when you power down to one power, you get a bigger eye box, right? The problem with that is if you go to five power instead of six, then your BDC does not line up. We go always first focal plane for sniper rifles, and there's reasons for that. But a lot of police departments will go second focal plane because you can get a really, really finite reticle, and you can power up and down, and the reticle will always stay the same size. The reticle in military scopes that are first focal plane are very thick, because as you power down, the reticle gets smaller, and if you build a small reticle, you lose it very quickly. It's a more complicated answer that I want to get into here, but there's pros and cons to everything. You just got to find what you need. Favorite U.S. historic site? There are so many, but when I saw this question, I actually thought of St. Augustine in Florida. There's a fort there that's really worth seeing. It's badass. The Spanish built it. St. Augustine is like the oldest city in America. And there's a fort there. And it's funny, when you look at those forts, they're built in such a way, kind of like not a diamond, but they have very distinct edges. And they're built so you can never attack them without being fired on, right? Imagine if you had a square fort, right? And your attack comes in and it puts ladders up. Then the other three sides that the enemy are not on can't shoot at them. But if you look at the design of those forts, they were built in such a way, if you go to any one of those walls, you can be fired at by multiple other walls. And you'll see it there. You'll see it in a lot of European forts. And you'll see it in fire bases that were built in Vietnam, were built the same way. And fire bases that were built in Afghanistan were built the same way for that purpose. It's a lot of kind of pointed edge like a star. Whereas if you hit, you think about a star, right? If you line up on a star, you can't line up on the point and attack it. But if you attack the wall with ladders or a breaching charge, you always have somebody else firing at you from multiple other angles. So I thought that was a really cool fort. It was cool to go through it and look at the thing. So that's worth a visit if you're driving down into Florida. St. Augustine, the Spanish fort there, was really cool. But there's so many. I can't really pick. About to go into jump week at airborne school. Any advice? A little nervous. I get it, man. I was nervous too. Feet knees together, obviously. When the problem in static line, especially in school where people don't know what they're doing, is it's the last 50 feet, right? Or last 100 feet. That's where accidents happen, because you have all these people coming in and landing, and they have what's called sky sharks that just come whizzing in from the side, and they're not even paying attention to where they're going. So avoiding everybody else, I don't know if they have toggles now, but the SWIC, the chutes in SF, the static line chutes, you can steer a little bit. The Army steered away from those, literally, because they didn't want, imagine the 82nd Airborne putting hundreds of soldiers out of a bird. You don't want them all steering. You want gravity to just take them and the wind to take them, so they're not running into each other. But you can pull the risers and change direction. I tried to avoid people the last 100 feet. And I did it in free fall school too. When I was in free fall school, you were supposed to open your chute at 4,500 feet. I opened at 5 grand purposely, because that put me above everybody else. So when I landed, they were already on the ground, because I didn't want these jackasses running into me 100 feet off the ground. So that's what I did. The parachuting, static line jumping, it's actually quite safe. There's a lot of checks and balances and the rigors and all that, build, you know, packing the chute and all that kind of thing. Yeah, feet knees together, do the PLF, you'll be fine. You went through 2 weeks of ground school. I went through 2 hours of ground school in Ireland. We literally, they showed us how a parachute deploys. They talked about if you land in wire, if you land this, send you this and this and this. If you land in water, do this. If you land in this. And then they said, do some PLF, some parachute landing falls off that bench. And I'd be like, all right, get in the fucking plane, let's go. And it was fine. So you are overtrained, overprepared, and you'll be fine. When I was in the Irish Army, the drop zone that we used free fall and static line was along the coast. It was in Gormanstown, if anybody knows the area, it's near Drogheda, right? So you're on the coast, so you might land in the ocean, right, in the sea. There was a main highway running there, the Dublin to Belfast Highway was right there. There was a main railway line running right there. There was like a big dump. There was multiple obstacles everywhere, and you're purely on the, and it's not even your, you really have control of it because it's the spotter, right? It's the jump master who looks out at a bird and says, based on the wind, I'm going to put you out here. And they used to have a thing called the bum spot. If the jump master put you out and you didn't hit the drop zone because he put you out in the wrong place, they had this toilet seat that they'd hang over his neck because it's a bum spot, right? And we had a boat out in the Irish Sea in case people landed out there, because you can get dragged in the water if there's a lot of wind and pulled underwater. I'm not trying to freak people out, especially if you're going into jump week next week. Not a lot of water in Fort Benning, but there was I remember when I was at jump school in Ireland, one of the guys landed in the ocean and in the Irish Sea, and he came back in soaking wet, and somebody said, did the jump master miss the drop zone? And the guy said, missed the drop zone? He missed the whole fucking country. Which I thought was pretty quick. Look, don't worry about it, man. All night jumps, if you close your eyes, it's actually quite safe. And just be careful of sky sharks near the ground. Feet and knees together. I have done tons and tons. I can't even remember how many jumps I've done. But free fall and static line, I've never had a malfunction, ever. But I've always been ready for it, right? So when that chute opens, be ready for a malfunction, because your mind has to be right, because you jump very low in static line, so you have very minimal time to make a decision, right? Get that reserve out fast, but be expecting it, but hopefully you'll never see it. All right, good luck. Once you're done, shoot me a direct message and tell me you got your wings, man. Congratulations. Same question. Thoughts on the Army SMU? SMU is Special Mission Unit, Delta and a few others. Did you like working with them, and did you ever think of joining them? I did, but I didn't for personal reasons. Plans to become a Green Beret didn't pan out due to injury. Any sage advice on moving on? The advice is move on. Stop looking back. Not for you. Things happen for a reason. You'll go into something better. But looking back and regretting and going, oh, if only, that's a road that leads nowhere. Move on, man. Move on with your life and put it down to experience and freaking drive on. Just don't look back. Ever worked with the New Zealand Defence Forces units? I never did. A country I'd love to go to is New Zealand. New Zealand, Australia. I'd love to go to both of those countries, man. I would love to. Maybe someday. Long ass flight. Where do you draw the line in questioning incompetent leaders respectfully? That's a great question. And again, leadership is a massive subject. So I don't know your background. I don't know where you work. I don't know the circumstances to this, but at a certain point, you have to get your mind right, okay? If you're a subordinate, then you need to support your leader, or you need to move on, right? If you're unhappy with the direction. So there's two types of people who kind of fight their leaders, right? Now, there's some people who just bitch and moan for the sake of bitching and moaning, but there's other people that really care and want things to get better. And it's frustrating for them that they can't make change, right? But if you are questioning your leader constantly, then you either got to get your mind right and understand that your subordinate's not your company, or you got to try to look for another job. It's easy to say, get another job, right? But you should always be looking. Just because you have a job, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be looking for a better job, honestly. So it comes to that certain point where you either live with your circumstance if you can't make a difference, or you move on. Or you become that leader, or you get promoted, right? But not knowing where you work and the circumstances of where you work, I really can't give advice on that one without more specifics. The best non-tactical knife, right? So, look, I am not, I don't fit in this tactical world, honestly, because I just don't buy into it a lot. Do I carry a knife? Yes, I do. I carry a little folding knife like this from Spartan Blades, and the only thing I use it for is opening Monster cans, because I don't have any fingernails, right? And every now and again we get a package here and I use it to open the package. Other than that, I don't. I have a bunch of knives. I got this, I think, on my team when I left, and it's a really cool knife, but it's so nice and so freaking badass that I'd never use it to do anything because I don't want to break the blade. I got this at a sniper competition once, and it's a really cool knife too. I don't even know who makes it. I'm not a knife guy. I think knives are lethal weapons. I think they're really cool. Kevin Estella has like 50 knives. Do I carry a fixed blade? No, I don't. I don't live on a ranch or I don't need a fixed blade. The best non-tactical knife, I don't know because I'm not a knife guy. The best one I have is this Spartan Blades one. Really cool. Spartan Blades is a really awesome company. It's right up the road here and it's a couple of retired Green Berets that run it. And we went there and we got a tour and they make beautiful knives, but you know, there's different types of knives and there's work knives and there's pretty knives that I'd never ever use. So I'm a terrible person to ask about knives because I'm not a knife guy. Kevin Estella is your guy. He's the knife guy. When you're 70 years old, how would you want to describe the previous 10 years? Man, so I thought about this. I saw this earlier and I thought about it and I was like, I'll come up with something. And now I'm sitting here going, oh shoot, 70 years old. Did I die? Is that what I'm doing? My eulogy? Well, here lies Kevin Owens, who's a multi-billionaire, inventor of the first scope with no parallax and the first bullet with no drag, no where gravity doesn't affect it. No, I'm kidding. Look, I don't even know what I'm looking for out of life at this point. I'll talk about this later on, but I did start my own company because I'd rather work for myself and be broke than work for somebody else. And that's just a point I'm in my life, right? So what am I looking for in life now? I want to make sure my kids are taken care of. I want to travel. Moving forward, I would love to teach. I would love to kind of help people out. And I don't want a lot of stress. So as soon as working for myself gets stressful, I'll just cut it off or I'll scale back. I'm not good at taking time off. I wish I was better. I don't really have any hobbies. But if I was 70 and I was looking back the last 10 years, I'd like to live in a freaking small house with a little bit of land in a rural area because the world is going to hell in the handbasket. And I would want to make sure my kids are good and they can visit and me and my wife just grow old together. And I'd look back at 70 and go, man, I've had Vinny for like 20 years and he's still rocking. And he's the first 20-year-old dog in the world. That's what I want. That was a weird question, but good one. Any advice for a guy who just joined the army in his 30s? So the thing is, if you join the army in your 30s, and again, by that question, it almost seems like you're putting yourself down, whereas you're not. You shouldn't be. You're mature. You're an adult. You have probably got some life experience, which are all valuable assets in the military, right? You are now kind of your peer group are very young men who do stupid shit, and I know they do because I was one of them, and so were you. And but you're an adult and you can make adult decisions, and that's a huge asset to any military and any military chain of command. So use that asset to your benefit, right? Be the mature adult that nobody needs to worry about. Start gaining leadership, and then later on nobody will know that you're in. Like if you join the army, let's say you're 30 and you join the army, which I was 29, you can get out at 50. You don't have to make the army a career either. You can do 10 years, 5 years, and you'll never regret it. You'll never look back and go, that was a waste of time. I don't think you will, right? So if you go in your 30s, don't look at that as a handicap. Look at it as an advantage over younger men who just don't make great decisions and don't have enough life experience to make good decisions. It's an asset. And commanders see that. They look at you and they go, I can trust that guy. He's a freaking adult. Okay? When I say an adult, obviously a 22-year-old man is an adult. But really, is he? Because until I was 25, I was punching people in bars and fighting in the street and waking up in pools of blood. And I was not real mature. What do you think about mandatory gender awareness training in the Irish Defence Forces? This is the world we live in, man. This is the world we live in, and you're just going to have to deal with it. And it's getting worse. Of course it is. And it's pushing stuff down, ramming it down our throats, but it's everywhere. And I had a guy who, when I was a first sergeant, and we were getting new, we were only training SF, and at that time SF was only open to males. It's open to everybody now. But we got civil affairs and psyops in to the RSOF Warrior Leader course. So I would have female students. So I needed to send one of my guys to equal opportunity training in the army. So I picked the guy. He went against his will, and he went there, and he was with a bunch of minority females, and that's who was running the course, and that's everybody that was at the course. And it was, he was such a fish out of water. Like, God bless him for doing it, because I don't think I would have. But they were teaching a class, and this is a government-sanctioned class by the U.S. military, and they taught in class that all men are rapists, and if they haven't done it yet, it's just because they haven't had an opportunity. How insulting is that? I mean, my God, to be teaching that. So again, 52 genders, men think they're women, men can give birth, all this garbage, it's getting worse. And I know you think by playing along, you're just making it up, but understand that if you're in the military, you've no freaking say. You can play along or you can get the hell out. I just hope that, you know, common sense will prevail, but I'm not optimistic, because now the whole psychiatric world all these medical schools that are producing psychiatrists are teaching this garbage. So it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And, you know, mutilation children who are confused. We won't let kids under 18, we won't let them drink, we won't let them vote, but we let them destroy their lives because they're confused. It's so bad, but it's everywhere. So vote, people who have the balls to stand up and say, no, stop this insanity. I've said it before, like, politics in America should be very confusing because it's such a influential world power, but it's actually very, very easy because one side has completely lost their mind. And so it's very easy to pick who you vote for here because one side's not even an option. And I don't agree with everything Republicans stand for, but I agree with absolutely nothing Democrats stand for. And you have to vote those people out, and we have to change this culture because, like I said, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But expect more of this. Cleared hot rant too. I'd love to. Andy Stump's an awesome guy, really nice. I think if I did another podcast with him, it would probably be better because the first time I did it, I'd never met him before. I didn't really know him. I don't really know him now, but I would understand that I would be able to joke more with him, and I kind of understand his mindset, I think, a little bit, but I'd love to. And I actually might be up his way soon if he wants to do it. I like Andy. I like Jack Carr. I did Jack Carr's podcast. Very down-to-earth guys, very common-sense guys. Don't take themselves too serious and don't buy into the whole BS, and that's very refreshing. How do you think your mom ended up so strong, and what's most important thing she taught you? So I talked about my mom, I don't even remember where, but she was a very, very strong woman, for people who don't know. She was a freaking rock star. And even though back then, minimal education growing up, but very intelligent, very ethical, never wanted anybody to... And I know my sister listens to this and she's probably in tears right now, but never wanted anybody knowing anything about her. Didn't want anybody knowing any of her personal, but very private person, which I was until I freaking got out of the army, apparently. But always wanted to keep up appearances, always wanted to pay her bills, always wanted to make sure her kids did the right thing. And 14 kids and nobody ended up in the jail or anything like that, right? Irish moms back then were so hard and so tough. My buddy actually, he told me a story one time, his younger brother got arrested and he was in the prison, not in the prison, in the jail with the cops, right? It was like drunk tank overnight. And his little old lady mom came in and she's like 60 and she's got the coat on and the scarf over the head. And she came in and she was like, is he okay? And they took her into the cell to see him, and he was passed out drunk in the bed, and she was like, oh, poor lad. And then whack, front kick, punch, elbow, like just started beating his ass in the bed in the cell. And that's what they were like, man. They were hard, but they were hard because they cared. My mom was extremely tough. I think partly because she had to be. You grew up in that environment, you have 14 kids, man, you gotta rule with an iron fist. But she also very loving, very affectionate, maybe not in a way people think today. I remember I went to Lebanon the first time, and Lebanon wasn't combat, but people did die there and get killed, right? And I was going, and I was probably 19, I think. And I was walking out the door with my bag because somebody came and picked me up. And I said, I'm going. And she said, okay, goodbye. And she turned around and kept washing the dishes. Now, she was probably tore up inside, but it just wasn't something, this whole affection, touchy-feely thing, it wasn't her thing, right? Now, so we all jumped in the car and we went to pick up another guy. And while he was loading his car, his bag in the car, his mom came out and she was in tears and she's hugging us. And I'd never met her before. I was like stiff and like, what's going on here? This is weird. But it wasn't true. I think Europeans are like that a little more than Americans, a little more standoffish. There was a guy in my team, a good friend of mine, Jason. Some of you might know him, but Jason's a freaking awesome guy. And he's a warrior. We were in Iraq and we were flying out on missions, combat operations out of the helipad at Area 4. And he was mad that the commander and the sergeant major would not come down and high five us and shake hands and give us the bump and say, hey, go get them guys. And I was like, I don't care. I don't want them here. Screw them. And he said, yeah, but you're a European. Europeans are cats. Us Americans, we're dogs. We like to have our belly rubbed every now and again. But my mom was very strong, very awesome. Now, what did she teach you most? And I saw this question and I thought about it. And, you know, we as parents, we teach our kids and we sound like a broken record telling our kids stuff. And sometimes we think it's not getting through. I will tell you that my mom, when I was probably, and I have no idea, probably 10, maybe less. Siblings, right? I have 8 sisters, right? And 1, 2, 3 are younger than me. So I either grabbed or hit my sister for something trivial, right? And my mom beat my ass. And I remember her standing over me with like me by the scruff of the neck saying, there's a lot of battered women in this country and you will not have one. Don't ever put your hands on a woman. And that I remember that. And I was like 10, right? That resonated with me. I've never put my hand on a woman. I almost thought that a man who beats a woman wouldn't hit a man. You're a fucking coward, right? Even when I was running, I was doing the op four, like doing the role play for the personal security course, where you're in the blower suit and you're coming up to the gas station and you're talking to women and you're trying to be creepy and all that kind of thing and you're saying things that you normally wouldn't say and you're trying to make them uncomfortable, you're trying to make them make decisions based on emotion and not the law. That was hard for me. And I remember teaching this class in Nashville, and before we went in, I said, I want to say something. I said, I have tremendous respect for women. I have a wife. I have 2 daughters. I have a mom who could have fought in the fucking UFC and beat some ass. If I say things to you, please don't think I'm disrespectful. I do it because I want to give you the best training I can possibly give you. And I owe that to you, right? I want to, and if I say something that makes you feel uncomfortable, there's a purpose to it. Like, there's things I wouldn't say, obviously, right? But it's funny because when you're a role player for a course like that, you can push women's buttons a certain way and then you can push men's buttons a different way. You just poke their ego. But my mom, I remember that moment 50 freaking years ago, wherever it was, and it has stayed with me my whole life. And I think it's such an important lesson. But yeah, she was a freaking incredible woman. I'll talk at the end about female role models. I think there's a lack of female role models in this country for young women. I would hate my daughters to be 13, 14 now, because this social media thing is out of control. And women find popularity on social media for certain things, right? And it should be for their accomplishments and because of the things they've done or because of their leadership or their skills and not. I mean, if you can think of 5 positive female role models, please put it in the description down below in the comments, right? Candace Owens would be one. Highly intelligent, very articulate, and actually quite courageous because she gets attacked a lot. But there's not that many. And you look at, there's a lack, if you look at young women, who do they look up to? Like, and who should they look up to? I'm gonna give you 3 examples since I'm on this right now. My wife, Tula, right? She's from Sweden. She's very reserved, does not want social media, does not want any. She works her ass off here. She does all her social media editing. She built this freaking podcast studio. She's building me one in the basement of our house right now because I won't be able to use this one again. She works hard and she wants no recognition at all. And it's maybe a European thing, but her payment, her sense of accomplishment and her sense of feeling that she did a good job is her payment, right? Whereas we're raising a generation of people now that can't go to the bathroom without freaking putting on Instagram, right? So that would be one, right? But she has no social media, so women can't look up to her, right? Kirsten Morgan, who's out teaching personal security right now, is a police officer for 12 years in Charlotte, which is quite a violent city. She was a patrol officer for 6 years. She was a SWAT team, full-time SWAT team member for 6 years. She is one of the best instructors I've ever seen in my career. She has a way of breaking things down and not talking down to students. She's very capable. I have a video on my Instagram of her clearing a house and she's really, really competent in the house. She cleared that house with me behind her on cell phone better than a lot of SF guys could clear it. And she kicked one of my, or she kneed one of my instructors in the nuts too, but it was a reaction. And then she giggled about it. But Kirsten is phenomenal. Kirsten wrote the personal security course for Fieldcraft Survival from the ground up. I give her guidance. She wrote all the scenarios, she wrote all the legal jargon, and she researched it and all that. But again, Kirsten has like 7,000 followers on Instagram because she is not willing to do the things that gain tens of thousands of followers. So these are the women that we should be pushing, but they're not. So Kirsten is at Rosie K-Bar, and she's a Fieldcraft instructor, and she's an absolute rock star, and she does a lot of stuff in the back, kind of behind the scenes in research and products and stuff like that. And she will never push a product on you. She hasn't tested it and evaluated. And I think these are they're the women that we should be pushing our daughters towards emulation, right? The other one, the last one I'll talk about is, and I'll put the links down below, is Carly Schroeder is an infantry officer in the U.S. Army, right? Now, she was a Hollywood actress, and she could have very easily stayed on that path for her own reasons. I'm trying to podcast her, but it's difficult with the military. For her own reasons, she pivoted into a career in the military, and not just in the military. She went into the infantry, which is combat arms and closed off to women until very recently. She went into the infantry, and she was a platoon leader in charge of 30 soldiers, right, in a male-dominated, testosterone-filled world. And now she's the XO, I think, of a company, 120 people. That's leadership right there. And that is, again, her social media is, she doesn't post that much. But these are the women that young women should be kind of aspiring to be and emulating. And I think I'd like to see more female role models out there for young women. I don't know how I got in that tangent, but oh, it was my mom. Okay, moving on. As a civilian, would you prioritize PBS-14s over a thermal device for general preparation? I don't know why you need NODs, brother. I don't have NODs. I had NODs, 31 alphas, belonged to the company. I'm sending them over to Kevin Estella right now. I don't have night vision goggles. I don't think things are that bad. If I was going to pay for a night capability, I would probably buy a thermal scope for my rifle, because a lot of... it's cheaper than NODs. PBS-14s are expensive. And you really need a laser, an LA-5 or a PEC-15 with that, because if you go out with NODs on a dark night, you're not going to see jack shit. If you look at Caitlin Lowe's, she has an Instagram account. She does a lot of hunting, thermal imagers, and they're uncool thermals. They only have so much capability, but you can mount them on a rifle and zero them, and it gives you a night capability. I just don't think... it's up to you, obviously, but I don't have night vision goggles, and I have no plans on buying any. But I would look at the price of a decent thermal, and then I would look at the price of a pair of PBS-14s, and you're going to need a laser, an infrared laser, or at least an infrared light on your gun. And I don't know, that's a lot of money, but obviously it depends where you are financially in your life. And people bash on PBS-14s all the time because 31 alphas are with, you know, white phosphorus tubes are like the new hotness. I ran all over the world with 14s. Freaking awesome. Awesome NODs, and that's what the Army still use. I prefer the 31 alphas because I like to see out of both eyes at night, but the 14's a good optic. If you can get a great deal on it, great, but I think you'll get a cheaper thermal. What is your main EDC everyday carry gun you've been carrying? So I carry Glock 19. It's super basic. It's got iron sights on it, no red dot, nothing fancy. because I think people get caught up in so much of this debate on guns, and people are like, Glocks are garbage and SIGs are garbage and Smith & Wesson. It's not. They're all really, really good. I carried that for 10 years now because that's what I had on a team in SF. And I wanted to carry the same gun I had at work, right? Now, if somebody gave me a super fancy gun and I liked how it felt in my hand and it fired well, I'd carry that. Before that, I carried a Walther P99. Believe it or not, people are like, oh my God, I loved it. It was a really cool gun. It felt great in my hand and I could shoot it really well. So the gun that you're trained on, the gun that you shoot well, is the gun for you. Don't buy into products and people pushing products and people on the internet pushing stuff all the time. Look, Smith & Wesson make great guns. Glock make great guns. SIG make great guns. Freaking whatever. There's, you know, you want to, there are cheap guns out there that maybe are unreliable, but they're pretty obvious. But the big manufacturers make really good guns. But I carry that. It's got, you probably can't even see it, but it's got an SF crest on it because when I came back from Afghanistan in 2014, they did this kind of deal with Glock where guys could get an SF crest one. And I can't remember what I paid for it, but it was like a commemorative one. I was not sure. I'll play along. I've shot competitively with a Glock 34. Love that gun. But there's a lot of good guns out there. That's what I carry. It doesn't mean it's the best. It's just the question was, what is your main everyday carry gun? Okay. How would you rate the M110 and 6.5 in overall performance? So the SOCOM is going towards, or at least USASOC, going towards an upper for the M110 and 6.5 Creedmoor as a sniper support weapon. The reason we went with Knights Armament is because we already had a contract with them for the M110 or for the SR25. And to pivot and put an upper on that is quite easy. To do a full and open competition is difficult. And it takes years and years and years. Now, this has taken longer than it should, but... And Knights Armament made the M110. The M110, initially, when Knights competed, it shot really, really well. But the requirement said a two-minute of angle gun, which was ridiculous. So Knights made a two-minute of angle gun. If you make Knights, the 6.5 Creedmoor is a sub-minute of angle gun, the ones that Knights are making for SOCOM, or they won't be bought. The contract will be cancelled. So if you force them to build a good gun, they can build a good gun. But if you ask them for cheap garbage, they're going to give you cheap garbage. And they used to call the old M110 and 7.62 old lightning because it never struck the same place twice. But that's the fault of the people in the Army who wrote the requirement not understanding what they were asking for. It's their fault, okay? Thoughts on registering AR pistols? Should I do it now while it's free? I don't want to steer you in the right direction, wrong direction. I tend not to talk about this stuff because what I do in regards to the Second Amendment is my business, and I'm not telling you to do anything illegal. That's kind of on you. Young leaders, man, that's a whole thing. Are you going to USASOC International Sniper Competition? I go every year, but I'm not going this year because I'm going to be out of town working. If you're on BRAG, if you can get into BRAG, which there's ways of going through the gate and getting into it for BRAG, but if you're there during that competition in March, you can go to it. And Thursday of that week is when all the vendors are there. And if you're interested in kit and gear, it's a really cool culture. I would go if I was you. And all the prizes are, the prize table is run by the SF Association because it's illegal for Army guys to touch prizes, right? So the prizes are donated to the SF Association and then they donate it to the competitors. But it's a really cool event, great culture, a lot of really tough events. But that Thursday, you can find it online if you just Google it, but I won't be there, unfortunately, but I have to go and do something else, which I'll talk about here in a bit. How does Vinny do it on gunshots when you're training? He doesn't like gunfire. He does not. And again, dogs have super sensitive hearing. Like if I'm shooting on the range, he'll go get in the vehicle. He'll go get hang out in the vehicle and I don't expose it to him. So somebody else asked me Vinny's backstory. Vinny was imported from Belgium to be a police dog. This is what I was told anyway. And he's not a bite dog. He's a big baby and he's a sweetheart. And I think if somebody attacked me, he would probably go nuts. But they made him a service dog. And they gave him to some kid who was a support kid in SF. And that kid gave him back and said he was aggressive and he bit his kid, which is complete BS. That's a lie. It didn't happen. And I think what really happened was this kid was trying to make him a bite dog and he wouldn't bite. And he didn't want that. He wanted the Malinois for the image, which happened. That there's a lot of that after the Bin Laden raid, and you got all these guys who freaking wanted to have a Belgian Malinois for the image. It's funny, when I got Vinny, I went and spent time at Labs for Liberty, and the lady there, after about 2 days, she said, after meeting you, I know you don't want him for the image. And I was like, I never even thought of that. So he gave him back, and then a trainer had him for a couple of weeks, and they talked to me, and he said, I've tried to make this dog bite me, and he won't. And he is the least aggressive dog I've ever seen in my life. He is just a sweetheart. So I got him. Luckily for me, he was given back. And I got him, and he has been phenomenal. And he's right outside now hanging out. He's just the greatest dog ever. But he doesn't like gunfire. All right. That was more questions. If I didn't answer your question, it's either I didn't get to it or I didn't want to answer it because it's personal. And bear with me. Now, what am I doing moving forward? So I've been kind of struggling with this a little bit because it kind of happened quickly, but I've come to the conclusion now. So when I put it on social media, I got a lot of job offers, right? And I really, really appreciated that, but I don't want to work for somebody else anymore. I'd rather work for myself and not make money than work for somebody else. So I started my own company called Overmatch Consulting. Overmatch is a term we used in Force Mod. If the enemy build a sniper rifle that shoots 1,000 yards, then we will build a sniper rifle that shoots 1,500 yards, and we have overmatch on our capability. That's where it came from, right? So I called it Overmatch Consulting, and I'm building a website right now, slowly. We live in a great time because I don't know anything about building a website, but I can freaking look on YouTube and watch videos and figure it out. And I might screw it up, but I learn every time I do. So it's just taking me longer than I'd hoped to do, but I'm not in a hurry. I have the email up and running, and it's like info@overmatchconsulting. And what I want to do is I want to do consulting for companies that are dealing with product development for the military or trying to get into the Army acquisitions program. I think there's a consulting piece on some other stuff too that I'm working on. I think there's a leadership consulting piece or public speaking, and then there's a training side to it. Now, what do I want to do on training? I am already going out to teach at a sniper course. I've had a couple of companies reach out and say, hey, we want to host you at our range. I'm kind of looking into that. The product development side, I've had some interest there. I'd like to get into the world of training police sniper teams because I think I got a lot to offer. But again, I'll throw it out there. The market is going to decide what I do going forward, right? This is my medium to get the word out. I was building the website, and it's like, you know, they give you a template, and I'm like, okay, talk about yourself. And I'm like, Jesus, I'm terrible about that. Well, I guess I'm not now, but you know, I put in very minimal information. I didn't play the Green Beret veteran combat, all that. It's just overdone. It's everywhere. So I just said, spent time in the Army. But I think that the training piece is military law enforcement. I think there's a civilian. There's a gap in the market in this country for regular folks like you and me, like I said, right? Regular training for regular folks. You know, it's funny because I think I put out before, I want to train civilians, but the right kind of civilians. And somebody asked, what does that mean? It means people who want these skills for defensive purposes and not offensive purposes. And I'll not teach sniper training to civilians. I just won't do it. I'll teach it to cops and military. I'll teach shooting to civilians because that's hunting and it's a sport. I think I've got a lot of potential here, but I don't want to work myself to death either. I'd like to pull in really good people that I know. And I you know, I'll make you a couple of promises right now. I'll never put an instructor in front of you representing me that I don't 100% stand behind. And I've vetted 100, like completely vetted, right? And I'll never push products on you that I don't believe in myself. I don't care what. Somebody called me the other day and they wanted me to do stuff on their product. I'm like, no, I'm not doing you. I'm not for sale. I won't. You can't pay me to push your product if I don't believe in it, right? So that's why I'll never be successful in this world, I guess. And I talked to a guy who called me, and if you're watching this, you know who you are. And I talked to him about 45 minutes, giving him advice on trying to get his product into SOCOM. And my wife was like, you're supposed to be a consultant. You just gave that away for free. So I'm bad at this. I'm bad at pricing things because to me it was just a chat on the phone. But I am going to build this out in the consulting piece, in the leadership piece, and in the training piece. Those three areas, I might do an online component through Zoom calls, either with small groups or just one-on-one. You want to talk about guns, personal security, you want to talk about medical stuff, you want to talk about ballistics for an hour, then you book a time slot, and you sit down one-on-one with me or one of the people, one of the very few people that will represent me, and you will talk through that area, and we'll build a POI. I just don't want it to be a chat. I want it to be an actual POI, because I always want to under-promise and over-deliver. So that's why I'm going to stop talking right now. So stay tuned. I'll try to get the website up as soon as I can get to it. I really do want the market to decide, which it gets to decide what I do and what's successful and what's not. So that was a long podcast. I don't usually do them that long. I appreciate everybody hanging in there with me. I hope I answered your questions. So I will put a couple of links down below to the social media accounts I talked about. If you go to overwatchconsulting.com, it's probably not up yet. It's not up yet because I'm the only one working on it, but it'll be up when I get it done, hopefully before I head down the road again. Because my goal is to keep overhead really, really low so I can pass that on to people, because I want people to be able to hire me. I'll do private training too, but that is difficult. But I want people to be able to hire me and not charge a ton of money. But as I'm driving across the country, I'll let you guys know when I'm leaving, and I'll do some content. And this place I'm going is freaking spectacular, and I'll do some content while I'm there. People ask me about scopes and stuff. I'm a little outdated on stuff like that, but the place I'm going will have everything, and I will be really, really caught up on that stuff, because I never want to put out bad information. And you just have to understand that anything I say in that world is my opinion, and it's based on my experience. And I haven't shot every gun or shot every bullet or shot every optic out there. I just haven't. Nobody has. So I'm very reluctant to kind of talk about stuff that I don't consider myself knowledgeable on. That was a long one. All right, guys. Thanks for hanging in there. I hope you got something out of it. And until the next time.